Democrats accusing China of threatening world stability, and Chinese officials saying the U.S. is a human rights hypocrite because of its mistreatment of its African-American citizens. Ties between Washington and Beijing particularly soured under former U.S. President Donald Trump, who clashed with China on trade, technology, regional security, among other issues. President Joe Biden's administration has generally backed the tougher approach initiated by Trump. Biden has described China as Washington's most serious competitor, saying the U.S. would continue to confront what he has called China's attack on human rights, intellectual property, and global governance. Beijing has rejected those charges and repeatedly said that the U.S. must stop interfering in its internal affairs.
In particular, this is the first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, in, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Well, joining us on tonight's debate, we have independent political analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Doctorow in Brussels. The meeting was far from a promising start. How do you think the Biden administration will approach dealing with China going forward from here?
I think the overarching element of U.S. policy towards China that has now been confirmed by the behavior of the American delegation in Anchorage is containment. The overarching principles of U.S. foreign policy under Biden, as relates to both China and Russia, is of the Cold War vintage. It is ideologically driven. It's based on an assumption that there is a free world and a world of countries that are ruled by autocrats, and that these are in constant confrontation, and that the United States is going to rally its allies under the umbrella of this free world. In this sense, the actions that the Biden administration took, both the president himself in his description of Vladimir Putin as a killer, and of the Blinken delegation to Anchorage by its public denunciation of China, they were in both cases trying to set the policy line for the allies to follow. And in both instances, I believe they made a terrible blunder, because Europe in particular is not the least bit keen to follow the United States in a confrontation that includes a trade and a power politics confrontation with China. As your as one of the quotations made at the start of this program, right, that China has one half of the economy, economic scale of the United States, that is extremely misleading. It depends how you calculate dependence very much on the exchange rate. And by purchasing power equivalency, many specialists would say that in 1 or 2 years, China will be bypassing the United States. And by normal exchange rate calculations, there's the wide expectation that China will have a greater economy than the United States by the end of this decade. In these circumstances, the European allies are not in the least interested in following the dictates of Blinken and Biden and spurning the Chinese or baiting the Chinese as Blinken was doing in Anchorage.
George Samueli, it didn't look like much of a reset in relations. China also had some strong pushback. What do you think is Beijing's view on this relationship, especially after the Alaska meeting?
Well, I think China is extremely annoyed with the Biden administration's policy. Let's keep in mind that what happened yesterday was an absolutely diplomatic calamity for the United States, because within hours of each other, both Moscow and Beijing humiliated the United States. And say what you will about the Donald Trump years and his aggressive, bombastic style of policymaking, such a thing never happened during the Trump years. Now, why the Chinese have responded in this particular way is that the Biden people have come to China not with putting forward a coherent agenda, which is what you're supposed to do whenever you have any kind of a diplomatic meeting, but with a lot of talk about values and the suggestion that somehow China is failing up to the U.S. desired values, that China is violating what the U.S. calls the rules-based order. Now, the Chinese really don't like that sort of talk, because they feel that the rules-based order is largely a fraud, whereby the United States and its allies make up the rules and everybody else has to follow orders. So they don't like that, and they particularly don't like when the United States starts raising human rights issues. The moment they do so, the Chinese invariably point to the human rights shortcomings of the United States. They point to obviously Black Lives Matter, but in a longer historic sequence, there's the general problem America has faced for many years with its African American citizens. But what the Biden people are doing is, instead of talking about palpable, real national interests, which is what Trump was doing, interests that involve trade, interests that involve currency manipulation, and interests that involved the issue of the virus. How did it come about? When did China know about it? What did China do to contain it? What did China do to alert the world to the danger of the virus? Instead of addressing these issues, the Biden people are talking about issues that are entirely internal Chinese matters. Hong Kong, Taiwan, the Uyghurs, Xinjiang, these are all, and Tibet indeed, these are all issues that the Chinese regard as fall within their jurisdiction, and it's not nobody's business but their own. And so when the Biden people talk about these things, it only serves to infuriate the Chinese. It is an absolutely calamitous piece of diplomacy on the part of the United States.
Mr. Dottaro, on that issue, the Chinese side have told the U.S. delegation that many people within the United States actually have little confidence in the democracy of Washington, and they have various views regarding the government of the United States. Does the U.S. have the moral authority to discuss democracy and human rights?
Well, it doesn't. And it's still, I would characterize these Chinese remarks as being very traditional in a Cold War discussion. They used to call this whataboutism. It was attacks on the Soviet Union for its human rights abuses, and Izvestia or Pravda the next day would have a litany of American abuses in the human rights category. And this brings us to what we are witnessing. As I said a few moments ago, this is a Cold War dialogue which is set up and imposed on China, on Russia, by the United States. Neither of these countries is guided by ideological considerations. They're very pragmatic, and they're very open to the world. It is the United States that has turned inwards on its own past. After Mr. Biden made his remarks about Putin the killer, the Russians, the Russian experts and Russian television commentators raised the question whether Mr. Biden is senile. And they debated this, discussed this from every angle. The consensus seemed to be that no, he is not senile, that he is fully conscious of the environment around him, and that he has a very good memory. However, in one sense, he is senile. He is trapped in time. His mindset is from 30 years ago, and he's brought that with him to the White House. The world has changed a lot since 1989. Unfortunately, Mr. Biden has not.
Mr. Samueli, what is China's main priority in its relations with Washington? What is it really looking for?
Well, I think that it's very happy to have a proper great power competition, whatever you call it, with the United States. If the United States has specific issues that it wants to address, such as trade, currency, etc., that China is happy to deal with those issues. What China won't tolerate is talk from the United States about values and obvious interference in its internal affairs. And they regard that what the United States has been doing in Hong Kong, what the United States has been doing in Xinjiang, is clearly interference in its internal affairs. And China guards its national sovereignty jealously. Now, there is a real problem here, and if we talk about geopolitics, which is that China is the power on the rise. It's risen very, very rapidly in just a matter of a few decades. It's the country that it was when Richard Nixon visited it in 1972 is just not a shadow of the great power it's become now. And the United States sees this. The United States resents this. And the United States is not going to allow it to be eclipsed easily. This is something that we know from history. Great powers do not let themselves be eclipsed by other great powers without putting up a fight, and the Chinese know this. And so the question now is, how can the United States accommodate itself to a multipolar world with Russia as a great power, China as an economic power that is at least the equal, if not the superior, of the United States? How can it accommodate itself to this multipolar world when the United States has really enjoyed several decades of ruling over a unipolar world? We hope that it will accommodate itself peacefully, but there's a real danger that peace is not on the cards.
Mr. Del Toro, the same question, but from a different vantage point. What does the U.S. really want from the China talks?
Well, in the United States, but in the world at large, foreign policy is often a projection of domestic policy. And nowhere is this more true than in the United States. Everything that we've seen in the last few days bears this out. Mr. Biden, in his remarks about Putin, was addressing the his own Democratic Party supporters. In the question of dealing with China and how it was handled in Anchorage, the Biden administration was looking to have a lockdown, to have a tight control over both political parties, since both Democrats and Republicans are rather close on this single issue in foreign policy. So what we saw in Anchorage was not so much, particularly in the open session, was not so much an interaction with the Chinese as an interaction with the American home viewers and home journalists. It was an attempt to impose the Biden administration views on domestic politics in the United States. It was not an outreach to China. Now, what may have happened behind closed doors, that's another matter. But I wouldn't look for a great deal. The United States is looking to maintain its global hegemony and to contain the powers that are rising. China is the most obvious rising power and rivals the United States in every economic dimension and also in technology. Russia is not obvious as a rising power, but it is, in fact. There is no comparison between Russia today and the Russia of the pre-1989 Soviet period. It is a leaner and a much tougher country, tougher in international policy and in power projection. It is a military force that rivals NATO, which the United States reluctantly faces. So the United States, in the last several days, has been facing up to its two main rivals, and has done so in a deplorable way, and I think is creating for itself great problems because Biden continues to do what the Trump administration has done, which is to drive its two rivals together.
Mr. Samueli, what happens if China takes a no-compromise approach? Many are already calling it the start of a new Cold War-type era.
Well, I think that's a very likely scenario. And now the United States is trying to create a Asian version of NATO, but there are no takers in Asia because India, South Korea, Japan, Australia, they have no interest whatsoever in getting into a confrontation with China, given the size and the scale of the Chinese military, and they don't really see any need for it. The issues that the United States is raising, the security issues about a variety of sort of uninhabited islands in the South China Sea, they're of no real concern to these Asian powers. Similarly, the border dispute between India and China. Well, South Korea and Japan couldn't care less about this border dispute. So the attempt to create an Asian NATO to contain China will not succeed. But there could be areas in which there would be conflict. I mean, China is building up through its Road and Belt and Road Initiative a variety of alliances throughout Africa and Asia. And the United States does not like it. And so that's an area in which the United States and China could well come into confrontation, particularly over an issue like Iran. I mean, Iran is a thorn in the United States' side, and China has been one of Iran's key allies. So that's an area where the United States and China could come into direct confrontation.
And one last question for Mr. Doctor before we close out the program. It's been quite a week in the Biden State Department. First calling Russia's Vladimir Putin a killer, then the exchanges between the U.S. and China. What happened to that less confrontational approach that so many were expecting from the Biden White House, and can this position be held in the long run?
It remains what do you mean by the long run? This position can be held for a good long time, and I think given the stubbornness of the American Congress and its general support for U.S. hegemony as the overriding feature of U.S. foreign policy, I think that Biden's measures will not be challenged seriously. And so the U.S. State Department may very well continue for the next 4 years what we've seen in the last week. The containment issue with China is very different from containment in the Soviet Union because of the technology and because of the scale of the country. The Soviet Union was always a fraction of the United States economy. China is coming up, nudging towards the same scale. And technologically, it is quite quickly becoming a peer of the United States. So containment is likely to fail miserably within this decade, but it will not be changed on the U.S. side next 4 years.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let me thank my guests, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent political analyst joining us from Brussels. Also thanks to a senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samuelli, joining us from Budapest. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's debate. It's good night for now, and see you next time, everybody.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنِ اللَّغْوِ مُعْرِضُونَ.
And they who turn away from ill speech.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ لِلزَّكَاةِ فَاعِلُونَ.
And they who are observant of zakah.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the beginning part of the chapter Mu'minun, specifically the third verse. وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنِ اللَّغْوِ مُعْرِضُونَ. And those who keep aloof from what is vain. So, in the previous programs, we mentioned that this chapter starts with the noble verse, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ, successful indeed are the believers, And continuing for several verses afterwards, this surah is trying to mention some of the attributes that lead to salvation and actually deliverance of the believers. And by having a closer look at the true meaning of these attributes, we understand that they are so comprehensive, they are so accurate, that we can have them covering various aspects of our social and even personal lives. Now, the second attribute mentioned in this chapter is in the third verse, وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنِ اللَّغْوِ مُعْرِضُونَ, and those who keep aloof from vain. In the previous program, we said that the Almighty Allah does not characterize the believers as those who abandon vain deeds completely and absolutely, because abstinence necessitates the existence of something inward that invites man to occupy himself with an action, but heedlessly and not giving any value to it, he turns his back upon it and he somehow busies himself with something else. In fact, someone who abstains from an action sees involving himself with that action as below his dignity and would rather pursue higher aims and more noble tasks. And this has to root from true believing. This roots from real faith, because a real faith calls on all of mankind to cultivate this attitude, because faith belongs to the realm of greatness and majesty and is actually the source of glory and splendor. So one who is faithful endeavors only to live for final prosperity. He is aiming to achieve eternal success. This man or woman who has real faith pursues activities that are considered great by Allah. In simple terms, he actually sees everything within the glasses of what the Almighty Allah has ordered him. He does not value the actions and conduct of the ignorant and ignoble ones.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
series
of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
If the ignorant addresses the believers answer them with kindness, and when the believers see vain activity, they deal with it with nobility and magnanimity. But what they do with regard to that vanity is that they try to keep themselves aloof. So, as a result, this state of the believers makes it clear that describing them with the quality of avoiding from what is vain وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنِ اللَّغْوِ مُعْرِضُونَ is somehow a metaphorical meaning. And it is pointing to the high determination, the high dignity and nobility of their personality. And this is what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said in a prayer. He alayhi salam says, O Allah, have mercy on me to be able to abandon sins totally while I am alive, and be merciful to me so that I do not get into troubles because of what is vain. In this regard, the Prophet ﷺ has said, the most honorable of people are those who abandon what is useless, and peace of self is achieved by abandoning vain affairs. Dear listeners, you may remember that we said some of the commentators believe that there are some different possible meanings for the term laghb in the verse, and in this regard, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, every speech in which there is no remembrance of Allah is vain. So we can infer somehow that vain, or what is in vain, is what actually stops us from the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. So what we get from this verse is that a good sign of a person's Islam is the abandoning of what is vain, and this will actually cause him to reach being from among the successful. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins?
Happy Nowruz celebration of New Iranian calendar year to all Iranians and all Farsi-speaking people around the world. I, on behalf of IRIB English Radio staff, congratulate you the beginning of spring.
Lecture. Sheikh Asad Ja'fari.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Was salatu was salam ala ashraf al anbiya'i wal mursaleen, habib qulubina wa tabib nufusina wa shafi' dhunubina, سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم وعلى بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، صاحب العصر والزمان، خليفة الرحمن، إمام الإنس والجان، ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولقد خلقنا الإنسان في كبد. صدق الله العلي العظيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Our discussion on stress and anxiety in Islam has reached its third discussion. And last night we talked a little bit about those factors that cause the stress and anxiety, اضطراب قلب, as they say in Islamic philosophy or spirituality, this anxiousness of the heart. And my premise in these lectures, you know, is sometimes in my conversation with people and my talks and what comes in my inbox and just kind of overhearing some people, I get the sense that, you know, they believe that the deen doesn't have any room for anxiety and stress. Doesn't even accept the fact that a believer should feel anxious and stressed at any time. That at all times there should be a level of, you know, serenity, a level of contentment, a level of, you know, this nirvana, this flying, this, you know, just this sense of calmness about them, that, you know, no matter what the dunya throws at them, you know, doesn't affect them at all. And if we adopt that incorrect philosophy, if we actually begin to think like that, then any moment of stress or anxiety, we're bound to equate that to the fact that not only am I not handling this properly, but my faith is low as well. Now, I'm repeating myself for the past 3 nights because I'm just tired of hearing it. Like, it's too much on one person to deal with the heaviness of whatever's making them anxious and stressed out. On top of that, the heaviness of the guilt that I'm just not a good servant of God either. I'm ungrateful. I don't appreciate what He's given me. People have it worse than I do. In the process, you completely just kind of, you know, reject it and downplay every emotion that you feel. I have no right to feel this way. There are people who are far worse off than me. And the further you push it down, the more it comes back even more ferocious the very next time. So the attempt now for the past 2 nights has been to give you examples, give us examples of some of the greatest people that we know who have been through moments of anxiety. I talked about Sayyidah Fatima and her array of emotions around the time of Saqifa and Ghadir and the death of her father. I talked about last night about the mother of Musa. وَلَا تَخَافِي وَلَا تَحْزَنِي. Don't fear and don't grieve. And I talked about also Bibi Maryam. Right? Remember, she says, يَا لَيْتَنِي مِتُّ قَبْلَ هَذَا. If only I had died before this pregnancy or the pains of pregnancy hit me. Right? Those are moments of immense anxiety and stress. The Quran now relates. Imagine. I mentioned yesterday, can you imagine now, Bibi Maryam had, even if she had what was to say that and go through that and think that, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to now put that into His book as one of the verses, is enough for us to know that He's trying to tell us, maybe, just maybe, that look, it's okay. If you are a pregnant woman who's about to deliver and you complain about the pains of pregnancy, it doesn't make you ungrateful. Like sometimes those around, those coaches who sit there and say, okay, breathe, don't sound ungrateful, don't complain too much, it's not good for the baby, and you just say, So these are things that we need to really truly understand. We talked last night about one of the causes of stress and anxiety in our life. And again, I'll repeat myself, I'm not an expert in psychology or psychiatry or those sciences. I want to present it in terms of the deen. Okay? We talked about one cause yesterday, and being the fact that when you look at some of the tactics of Shaitan, he talks about, I will ambush them from the front. One of the explanations of the front is that we just simply end up thinking, no matter what I do for God, it's never going to be good enough. I'm really banking on Him being super merciful towards me for me to get in. And if He isn't, and if it's only based on kind of ones and zeros, and what I did and what I didn't do, then I'm going to have a horrible afterlife. That causes a lot of stress and anxiety. We talked about that yesterday. What I want to focus on tonight are two things. The first thing is that I want to further visit this notion that a true believer is one who should never be anxious and stressed out. I kind of feel that's a very old school mentality. Our older generations just say, don't worry about it. You know, they're very carefree, right? Borderline careless almost sometimes, but definitely carefree. Not to the sense that they didn't care, but, you know, they were perhaps a little bit stronger because they saw more, right? They dealt with more. They saw poverty, let's say, for example. They saw, you know, tragedy. They saw hardships at a very deep level. Not that we don't, but, you know, sometimes, you know, It's a different ballgame when you talk about the generation before us. Anyways, so I want to address that. And secondly, I want to go through a second cause of spiritual anxiety and spiritual stress inside of us. Okay, but first, let's tackle this notion, this first one. And where I'll begin with is this idea that this world, this dunya that we live in, this alam in nasut, alam in mifal, the lowest, asfal as-safil, however you want to describe this world that we live in, it is a temporary world, one that will perish. Kullu man alayha fan, everything will perish, including this dunya. It's a temporary abode. It's not made to be attached to. One of the purposes beside this dunya, because all of behind this dunya, and all of us know, we understand that our creation was made at the level of a very azim and a very great creation. Okay? We know enough to know that Allah gave us a body and gave us a soul, and that soul, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِ, is part of His soul, meaning part of Allah's soul, part of His ruh, His spirit, whatever that means, is a tafsir class, not this class. And this abamat had caused him to say, فَقَعُوا لَهُ سَاجِدِينَ, all of you now bow down to this Adam. Okay. Then he decides Allah to put him on this earth. Right. In fact, that was always the plan from day number one. Sometimes this notion that right now we, human beings, are paying for the mistake of Adam in the heavens is an incorrect notion inside of the Islamic teachings. Adam was always made for the earth. Even before the creation of Adam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala described to the angels in Surah Baqarah, إِنِّي جَعَلُوا فِي الْأَرْضٍ خَلِيفًا fil ardi khalifa, on this earth I'm going to make a khalifa. So Adam, even before creation, he already had his mission laid out for him. Okay, it's not like all of a sudden because he went towards that tree, that forbidden tree, now all of a sudden now the plans have changed and now he's going to be sent down to earth and we're now paying the price for his one mistake. No, not the case at all. That's not what we believe, at least. Okay, but why did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala send us down on this earth? This earth that we know is asfal as-safilin, the Quran describes, the lowest of the lowest of the lowest of the worlds. Okay? There are worlds. And as we die and move on to the next world, we enter that next world, right? Malakut, Jabarut, whatever the case may be. The one thing that I want all of us, especially myself, to understand is that this world is bound to produce anxiety and stress. This world is bound to produce hardships and struggles. There's no secret in that. I talk about this wherever I go, I find. But it's important that we remind ourselves, especially when we are in the middle of a pandemic. A lot of us, you know, don't know what's going to happen. This fear of the unknown is causing a lot of stress and anxiety. We're watching numbers go up, numbers go down. We're watching the flattening of the curve, watching, you know, this and that. People are losing jobs now. You know, relief programs from the government. All these things are out there. And with that comes a lot of anxiety. Our elders have no idea what's going to happen, right? Individuals who have older parents are stressed out about their parents. And the reality is that this is what this world is about. The verse I read for you in the khutbah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that we have created the human being in the cradle of distress. وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْتُمْ إِنسَانَ فِي كَبَدٍ, inside distress, to see how will they react. Okay? And that's, I have to submit to the fact that that's how God now is showing us our true colors, is through hardships. That's it. The faster we accept that, the faster we'll be able to move on. If we don't accept that, if we see every hardship to be nothing but punishment from God, or some evil plan of God, then every hardship will drown us. And I've seen people fly through hardships. I've seen people drown in hardships. I've seen people find their wings and elevate. I've seen people, you know, convince themselves, this is my rock bottom. I belong here, and I'm not going to go anywhere else. And the one point that I often make, I want to make here as well, is that I have to remind all of you and myself that Allah sees things in entirety. He sees our life in one glance. We see our life and live our life moment by moment by moment by moment. And sometimes we make drastic decisions in this one box of a moment. And the longer we live and the more we experience, we realize that that box number two, when I was 15, 21, 25, now has come back to kind of reveal itself in box number 31 when I'm 58 years old. But while I was going through that box, it was the end all and be all. And God's like, look, just get through the issue and you'll see exactly why you place that in front of you. So yes, sometimes, as I mentioned before, there is a level of discomfort for a greater good, for a more permanent change. Sometimes it's important that this pandemic happens, that we all sit in our homes, allow the world to repair itself, allow everything to kind of regain and refocus and restore itself into its natural ways, and then once again now release the humans back into the world. Right? You look at how many things have come out of this pandemic. For example, just recently we talked about the fact that there's now an overflow of food that people are throwing. The farmers have no idea what to do with potatoes, for example. Okay? Before, there was consumption. Now, there's not so much consumption because, you know, we're watching what we buy. We're not so much going out to eat. We're not having takeout, et cetera, et cetera. Or another way is that we can see the animals are flourishing. We can see that the planet is healing. Pollution is down, for example. Right? I mean, there's a report that I heard about in India of some man being interviewed asking, you know, how do you find this pandemic? He said, well, I can tell you one thing. This building in front of me, I've never seen this building in front of me for as long as I've been living here because of the sheer pollution inside of my city. Now, with this isolation and seclusion, the pollution now has gone, and I can see how many buildings now I live around. I couldn't see that because of the pollution from the cars and from the machines and from the companies, et cetera, et cetera. So there is always, always some form of khayr when it comes to a temporary moment of pain, at least when it comes to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, and that happens in this dunya. This dunya was made to test us. Nowhere anywhere do we ever see a verse of the Quran, a hadith, let's say, of the Ahlul Bayt, that talks about the fact that you will find serenity and sukoon inside of this world. Yes, you might find a little bit of comfort here and there. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub. It's very possible. But overall, this is a dunya to kind of get through, get over. It's a test, an exam. It's over with. Let's move on to our actual existence, which, of course, is the hereafter.
Salli ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
The faster we get, understand that every hardship that comes our way in this world is precisely the function of this dunya. I won't look for things in this world, the world that it won't give me. I'm not looking for, you know, itminan al-qalb. I'm not looking for the comforting of the heart. I'm not looking for all these things. Not in a depressing and gloomy way. But yes, okay, I know that I'm going to go through another hardship. I'm going to go through another struggle. And Allah knows that with every struggle you go through, the next one seems a little bit more bearable because you're now a little bit more tougher. Okay, that lessens the anxiety. At least it makes it bearable. I know why I'm going through this anxiety. I know the purpose of this stress right now. Sometimes when you know the purpose of the stress becomes bearable. When I don't know why it's here, what am I doing, where is this from, a sign of God, a sign from Shaitan, what's happening, can you please answer my question? That adds to the anxiety. We end up now making something bigger than it should be. Okay? That's point number one I want to make to you. Point number two is a second cause of our spiritual anxiety and stress is behind us. And I talk about this a lot. And the reason why I keep repeating myself in various communities is because I see it too many times. I see this defeatist attitude too many times. Either it's the fact that we think that my past is too horrible for me to move forward, Or I don't even deal with my past, thinking that if I bury it, it won't come up or rear its ugly head later on in my life. No, sometimes it will. Right? Sometimes we have unresolved issues from our past with people that we've decided, oh, you know what, I'm just going to bury it and bury it and bury it, and it comes back every single time, more ferocious than the last, to the point where it ends up being a panic attack, ends up being an anxiety attack, ends up affecting our health, becomes psychosomatic, where our mental baggage now, or our past now, comes in and haunts us in the physical way. We become sweaty. We can't breathe. We hyperventilate. Our heart is racing. Right? We feel nauseous. We feel tingly. In the process now, we make ourselves worse. Because I don't want to go back there. I don't want to handle those things. I don't want to address it with my parents or my spouse or my siblings, let's say, for example. Who, you know, when I was getting older, when I was growing up, you know, I was teased. I was never accepted inside of my home. Wasn't raised properly. Wasn't given equal love from my parents. Right? I was always told by my teachers and my friends that I would amount to nothing. Right? I was this overweight, ugly kid in school, for example. I was, you know, et cetera. And the list goes on and on. And we think from, oh, that was high school. That was grade 8, grade 12, grade, you know, university. That was a long time ago. I'm over it. And all of a sudden now this anxiety comes out of the blue. This stress comes out of the blue, and we have no idea where it comes from. I have no idea why there's tears flowing down my face. I have no idea why I'm shaking right now. I have no idea why my heart is racing out of the blue. All night, tossing and turning. My pillow is drenched with sweat. Why? No, I'm comfortable. My family's good. My marriage is good. I live in my house. I'm very peaceful. What is it? And when you get deep and deep and deep inside, you know that there are things that are unresolved inside of us. Unresolved. And again, I don't mean to be somebody who you know, is a psychiatrist. I'm not by any means. But it is important. It is important that we go back and we address those things with individuals. I remember, you know, it's a story I've told before. I want to say it again. My first couple of years in the house, and, you know, I will, you know, I still have some time, but I want to make sure I get the story right. They have two sets of teachers in the house. One set of teacher... is that teacher that teaches you the book, right? Is the Kitabi Ustad. And the other one is your spiritual guide. A Murabbi almost, right? A person who is trying to like give tarbiyah to your soul, okay? I remember I had met the spiritual guide in my second or third year in the Hausa. I was introduced by another individual, and I had a one-on-one meeting with him. And he asked me, you know, what do you see yourself in terms of your struggles? And these are what my struggles, not that I was, I wasn't openly confessing sin. I was talking about my akhlaqi behavioral struggles. This is what I fight with on a daily basis. And he told me to make two lists. Okay? And I want all of you right now, if you can, to mentally or maybe physically make two lists. One list number one, list number two. It is an unbelievable exercise. On the first list, I want you to write all those names of people that you have wronged. Okay? Whether it's verbally lashing out, whether it's an email you sent that was nasty, whether it's an argument you had in front of and somebody else, a post you made about them, I don't know, a comment you made in high school that you thought was funny but really hurt them, make that list. The second list are people who have wronged you. Okay? Who have wronged you. Okay? Someone who, as I said, you know, inappropriate comments, something that was made public, you know, those kind of things. All those things are there. You know, make sure that you make those two lists. And then he says to me that as you go through each list one by one, right, on the list of those people who have wronged you, he says, fix it. Fix it one by one. If you feel this deep down sort of like disappointment and pain because of them, even though it was years and years ago, then approach them. If you can, if they're around, if it's possible, approach them and talk to them and say, look, you know what? You know that thing that happened between us years ago? I just, you know, I want my closure, as they say. Now, you'll sit there and tell me, well, say that was what, 15 years ago. You know, we've moved on, time has healed. If you think time has healed, that's fine. But it is important that we do a little bit of muhasaba, a little bit of self-knowledge and self-thought and self-accountability to truly understand what are those things in the pit of our stomach that causes a little bit of this movement inside of us where our stomach goes crazy now, our BP goes up, we begin to sweat, right? If it's a sibling, if it's a parent, if it's a first cousin, if it's a spouse, if it's an in-law, if it's a friend of yours, address it. Address it whenever you can. Okay, when I say address it, I mean bring it up. Like now you're older, they're older, hopefully maturity has kicked in. You can have this conversation with them. I remember when I did this exercise, I'm still doing the exercise. It's been over 10 years. I'm still going through my list one by one by one. Can you imagine? I remember I approached one person, and this is a true story. But, you know, when I was a little bit younger, I thought I was this funny guy in school, right? The class clown, comments here and there, little snide remarks, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes I thought that, you know, in order for you to be funny, you're being funny at the expense of somebody else, okay? So while I got a cheap laugh from the class, I could tell that person wasn't too happy with my comment. Or I would do that inside of my community, let's say, for example. Sometimes on an open mic. And I remember specifically when I really sat down and thought long and hard, thought to myself, okay, this one person I have to approach. And I approached this guy. He was married. He had kids in my community. He was a lot, obviously, you know, he's younger than me, but we moved on in life. And, you know, with him and a little bit of courage, I remember one day after a program, I pulled him aside and said, look, you know, I wanted to talk about what happened, you know, 15 years ago. This happened, that happened. Do you remember? He says, I remember. Of course I remember. I said, what? And I said, I just wanted to apologize for that. It was wrong with me. Okay? And you know what he said to me? He said to me that I have been waiting for you to apologize to me for a long time. And I feel so much better now, so much lighter now. He felt light. I felt light. We had a hug. We had a moment, you know, before social distancing, don't worry, all that, right? And that was one off my list. And you wouldn't believe how much of the anchors of the heart were lifted from that one exercise. And I went through one person by one, and I'm still going through the list. So if you're out there, you know, hoping to hear from me, inshallah, you'll hear from me. Inshallah. On the same time, those who have wronged you, maybe approach them and say, look, this is how I felt, right? I mean, is this wrong? Like, you know, I would have liked it if you had did this or said this. If you're able to, again, please understand, if you're able to. But we have to address these things. And if we're not able to address them with the person directly, find an outlet. Find an outlet. One of the most beautiful things that we have in our arsenal of outlets is dua. It's dua. This treasure of dua. You know, Imam Sajjad, alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alayhi, talks about the philosophy of dua. Dua. And by the way, the Ahl al-Bayt are those individuals, that family, that beautiful treasure of ours that not only taught us, you know, the beauty of dua, but left the actual words behind for us to say this on this day at this time of the day. These are the words you are to repeat. One such thing that he mentions, Imam Sajjad, it's a very beautiful concept. He says that when you do dua, when you actually ask Allah for something, don't just assume that God knows what's inside your heart. He does, obviously. He says to verbalize the dua. Speak the dua. Allow your ears to hear the dua come out of your mouth. When that happens, the ear being the ear of the soul, or that avenue of the soul, it goes right back to the soul. Says, look, this individual now is expressing their hajat or their desire, their dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When the ear hears the mouth ask Allah, the ear becomes stronger in its iman, and because it's a path of the soul gets stronger. Right? And in the process now, when you believe that you have Allah there to lessen your anxiety and lessen your stress, it becomes a little bit more bearable. It becomes a little bit more bearable. So find your outlet. Have an outlet. Don't assume that it's okay. It's buried inside of me. It was a long time ago. I've forgotten about it. When one day you wake up, all of a sudden you can't describe or you can't even identify why my body right now is going through all of this until you actually talk about it. When you talk about it, all of a sudden all the symptoms go away one by one because now you're addressing those things inside of you. you know, the story of Nabi Musa alayhi salam is a beautiful one. It's one that I'm actually doing in the month of Ramadan for a different community. And I'm just in an immense amount of lessons revisiting that story that I've heard a little bit when I was a little bit younger. But one of the areas is that when he flees Egypt and goes towards this the city called